Saludos. La conversación que vas a escuchar está grabada en inglés. Pero no temas porque en el vídeo de YouTube que dejamos en la descripción puedes encontrarla plenamente subtitulada tanto en inglés como en castellano. Este es el primero de una serie de episodios donde entrevisto a personas que no son de habla hispana, o al menos no podrían tener estas conversaciones en castellano. El canal seguirá siendo en castellano, pero ocasionalmente daré cabida a voces y perspectivas de otros países. Después de todo, la finalidad de la encrucijada es acercar posturas muy diferentes. Disfruta de este episodio y no olvides dejarnos tus comentarios.
Welcome to La Encrucijada, which we shall call The Crossroads from now on, because this is going to be the English-speaking part of our podcast. So it's a great pleasure for me to welcome Robert Beat Mullins and John Pontifex to our studios today. John, you have a very peculiar surname, Pontifex. Can you tell us a bit about how you got it?
Well, it depends whether you want the family legend version or the more realistic version.
Family legend.
Family legend. There was a naughty pope called Martin IV sometime in the depths of the Middle Ages, and our family, without any evidence at all, is supposed to be descended from him.
Okay, and why, how did he get the name Pontifex?
Pontifex is Latin for bridge builder, which, as you may know, is the title of the Pope, Pontifex Maximus, the bridge builder between heaven and earth. And despite it having come from the Anglican side of my family, nevertheless, we are Pontifexes. And no one is quite sure why.
Okay, so there's even more of a mystery behind it, because an Anglican family presumably wouldn't be expected to have the surname Pope or something like that, or bridge builder referring to Pope. Mystery.
One would assume not.
We don't know. Yeah. We have another peculiarity in the room, so Brother Bead, could you tell us why you dress like Gandalf the White, please?
Well, I'm not a magician, unfortunately, but I'm a Dominican friar, so I'm a bit like a monk, although whereas monks stay in one place, Dominicans or friars tend to move around. So I belong to a religious order that was founded in the 13th century, in fact, by a Spaniard, St. Dominic. And our proper title is the Order of Preachers, because the order was founded to be a missionary order, to go out and preach and to teach as well, in particular. But as a nickname, we're called the Dominicans after our founder.
Mm-hmm. And where are you based at the moment?
So at the moment, I'm based in Oxford, in England, in a priory we have there, which is a separate institution, but also is connected with a hall of Oxford University, and also acts as a college for training priests. So at the moment, I'm training to become a Catholic priest.
Mm-hmm. So you're not a priest yet?
So no, I'm not a priest yet.
So what kind of studies are you doing?
So the studies are a mixture of philosophy and theology. We do 2 years of philosophy and then 4 years of theology. And the philosophy is fairly general. The theology as well is fairly general. But I suppose it has a practical aim, which is to make sure that people know what they need to know in order to be able to give spiritual advice and moral advice, and to help people live good Christian lives when you're made a priest.
Quite a burden to carry on your shoulders.
Yes, I try not to think about that so much.
You shouldn't. Well, before I ask you more about theology, which is the topic of our podcast today, John, I wanted to mention that you've just finished writing a novel. Is that right? And if I understand correctly, you've turned it into an audiobook, which is available online. So
yes.
A little advertising moment here.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, the novel is called Sandcastle at High Tide, which is a metaphor for the plot and the process that takes place in the book. I wrote it last year, and I have spent this summer turning it into an audiobook and a YouTube channel, yes.
Mm-hmm. What's the main plot, if you could give us something?
Of course. It takes as its starting point our internet-saturated world, and I wondered what our world would look like if we suddenly lost access to the internet. And in the novel, following a solar storm, this is exactly what happens, and the characters are left to face all kinds of issues of the group dynamic, social questions, friendship, and so on. So some action, very centered on discussion, some philosophical reflection, character development, how people would handle such a situation.
Mm. It's a bit sci-fi, but not sci-fi, because it could actually happen, the idea that you suggest in this novel.
Yes, we often tend to think that anything dramatic or anything leading to social upheaval would have to involve some elements of fantasy or science fiction. But I think that this is something which, though not a very strong possibility, is actually possible. Mm-hmm. Scientists have predicted that there's actually annually about a 1% possibility that a solar storm of such a magnitude could actually occur. So it's more like it's more like a starting point for the kinds of dilemmas and social questions and interior examinations and so on which one would not be forced to consider in normal life.
Mm-hmm. Where can the listeners find your audiobook?
It's the primary platform for it is a YouTube channel of this name, Sandcastle at High Tide, and there's also a podcast version underway. Let's just say.
Underway, okay. Well,
yeah, it's the same. So let's just say.
Well, we have like twin podcasts, which are starting around the same time.
Hopefully. Yes, we do. Yeah.
We'll try to support each other. So the topic today that I thought we could talk about is theology, and not just the academic study of God, but actually how can we reason about God or know anything at all about God. Both of you have studied in Oxford, at Oxford University, and both of you have studied theology, but ironically you haven't studied theology as your first course of study. You did something else in Oxford first. Could you tell us a little bit about what you did as your first degree and then how you got into theology, maybe Brother Bede?
Yeah, so at the moment, like I say, the connection we have with the university is separate from the training place, or what we call the studium for training priests. So I'm not actually doing a degree at Oxford University at the moment. I'm doing that through a separate institution. But my first degree before I joined the order was at Oxford University, and I studied classics. So in England, classics is a mixture of Latin and Greek language, literature, history, and philosophy.
The queen of the Greeks in Oxford, as all Oxford students know.
Yes.
Well, classic students are known for, you know, having a high view of their own studies, let's put it that way.
They are.
Would you say yes?
Well, it's at least not a false modesty.
Okay.
That's
a double irony.
So I only started studying theology actually in a quite different context, because of course the University of Oxford is historically Anglican, Protestant, I suppose, in a certain sense, rather than Catholic. Anglican, though, is a distinctive thing. And of course, nowadays functions really as a quite secular university. Whereas the setting in which I study theology is obviously very definitely a believing setting, because we're training for people for a real life and ministry in the church. So it gives, I suppose, a different kind of atmosphere or a different attitude to the study of theology than you might find in an ordinary secular university.
Mm-hmm. Quite a change in, you're still in Oxford, but it's quite a change in register, so to say, because you don't do...
Exactly, yeah. So Oxford, of course, is dominated by the university, and although we interact with the university in various ways, when you're not a full member of it, it does change the kind of way in which you inhabit the city.
Mm-hmm. How about John, your journey from your first degree in Oxford to studying theology a number of years later?
So I came to theology in rather a roundabout way. My first degree was history, and the only reason I didn't study history and philosophy was because it was not offered at Oxford. And in my first year, I started to question maybe I should have studied philosophy. And then I came to the end of my history degree, and instead of studying philosophy, I decided to study theology instead, for two reasons. Number one, I wanted to understand my faith more deeply, also in an academic way, so in a more intellectual way, be more aware of the theology traditions of the church. And also I had this view of, I was quite influenced by, I read de Lubac's Catholicism around that time.
Could you say a bit more about de Lubac, who he was? theologian.
Yes, I read the book Catholicism by 20th century Catholic theologian Henri de Lubac, and Pope John Paul II's Fides et Ratio. And I had this idea, I was quite taken by the sort of the idea, the effort to combine things and holistic attitude and philosophy and theology. And I thought I would have history, philosophy, or first history, then theology, and then go on maybe to study a doctorate in philosophy, which ended up not happening for other reasons. And together, this would be form a very sort of strong combination and strong relation of things. But I thought as a Catholic philosopher, I should have a strong understanding of my faith and be able to know the relation of the disciplines to each other.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because when we think of theology, at least when I think of theology, I tend to think of Catholic theology. But of course, in Oxford, you have different, very different kinds of theology that meet in principle. So what would you say is the place of theology in the academic context of Oxford? What kind of theology is done there? What degrees are there available in a very vague sense of theology? And how does Catholic theology fit into that?
I'm not too qualified to answer that question. That was actually partly the reason why I chose to study theology elsewhere in a Catholic context. So,
because you implied that it was not so easy to find the kind of Catholic theology that you
would. Not so easy to find, and I probably could have found it. I had friends studying theology, and from their experience, I decided that if I want to study philosophy, I want to be open to all philosophical traditions. But if I wanted to study theology, I wanted to make sure that I'm getting Catholic theology.
The Catholic tradition.
Mm-hmm. Catholic tradition. So
what would you say, Bede, is the...
Well, a lot of universities now don't speak about having a theology degree necessarily, but about a theology and religious studies degree. So what this tends to mean is that the degree is presented not from a non-confessional point of view. That means from a point of view that isn't necessarily committed to any particular believing tradition or any particular religious practice. So the focus tends to be on study of historical materials and cultural materials relating to the religions. So things like Holy Scriptures. In Oxford, there's always been a very strong tradition of studying the Church Fathers. So these are the Christian writers of the period immediately after the New Testament, from the first through to the 6th or 7th century. And it is possible for people to study more modern theology as well, or theology, I suppose, if they are believers, from within something of a believing standpoint, but that's really not the focus of the degree. So like I was saying earlier, there's quite a difference between studying theology in a context where it's taken for granted that everyone is believing and shares a kind of belief, and studying theology in a context that is radically pluralistic, that actually doesn't want to take anything for granted because a certain ideal of objectivity is upheld, which you might find in the social sciences or in historical study or in other forms of anthropology or cultural study.
Mm-hmm. So the big question that comes to my mind is a clip. I think it's illustrated by a clip that I watched recently, which is an interview with Richard Dawkins that this famous atheist YouTuber called Alex O'Connor did. And it's a very short clip, which is called something like, watch how Richard Dawkins tells a theology student that his degree is useless. And it's basically Dawkins making a case against theology as an academic discipline, saying that it is basically, at best, it can be anthropology, a form of description of what a society or a community believes, so the set of beliefs that characterize a particular society, that there can be no such thing as an academic theology in the sense of let's talk about the Trinity or let's talk about who God is, etc. So what you were saying just now about the status of religious studies, which is more of a term that comes from sociology, I would imagine, and it has this more descriptive status. There's this difference in styles, we would say, right, between
religious studies, as I understand is the usual way of doing theology in Oxford, versus what we call theology in the Catholic tradition, which is, has a more specific meaning. Could you say a little bit more about that contrast between the style of religious studies in Oxford and Catholic theology as we understand it?
So precisely the fact that a theology and religious studies degree can be studied by an atheist signals that it's quite a different exercise, or potentially quite a different exercise, than the case of the believer studying theology. Now, I think we have to be cautious, because it is possible for both an atheist and a believing Christian to study a degree at Oxford, and with the same subject matter, they might take very different approaches. So what for the atheist may well be an interesting cultural or historical study carries extra force for the believer. Whereas St. Athanasius, say, who was an important bishop in Egypt, ancient Egypt, in the 4th century, yes, in the 4th century.
They can look it up. Yeah, they have Wikipedia.
For a Christian, his writings might carry some authority, or he's someone that you engage in dialogue with about something that's actually true. Whereas for the non-believing person, you look at St. Athanasius to see the kind of things that Christians believe or should believe, or the way that a Christian might intelligently articulate his faith. So I think there's actually something, I suppose, true in what Dawkins says, which it's worth acknowledging at this point, which is this, that if Christianity is not true, then studying theology is only going to have a very, very limited value. It's going to be a purely academic discipline. It's even going to be a somewhat antiquarian discipline. And the theologian who really believes, if he comes to the end of his life and finds out that actually there is no God, or God is not a trinity, or God never became man, well, he's going to be disappointed. But it's also worth saying that actually, even if you are a believer, that's still true in some sense, because the believer holds that when he gets to the end of his life, if God willing, he enters heaven, still all the things he was talking about are going to disappear in a puff of smoke, as it were, because the reality is so much greater than anything we can really communicate here on earth.
Mm-hmm. Can you just comment on that last thing? What do you mean exactly by the things that the theologian has been studied here will disappear?
So the crux of the crux of the religious problem, in a certain sense, at least in modern Christianity as we understand it, is that you have to make an act of faith. So-called religious truths are not just obvious. There isn't direct evidence for them in the way that there is for historical or natural scientific phenomena. And that act of faith depends on a tradition of words, certain formulas which have been handed on, passed down to us, and are given body in a certain form of life. But that form of life and those words, at the same time as giving us some kind of understanding, always serve to remind us of the fact that what we're really talking about, what we really want to get at, is in fact completely hidden from us. It's completely invisible. And it's only at the end of this life, once we pass beyond the possibility of doing theology, that actually we have any chance of seeing with our own eyes, to use a metaphor from Christian tradition, from scripture, seeing with our own eyes what God really is. We can talk about a Trinity, and we can make lots of more or less intelligent and or intelligible comments, like he is one God in three persons. But what that really means is never going to be evident to us until we aren't on this earth any longer. The famous Dominican theologian, St. Thomas Aquinas, who, being a Dominican, belonged to my order, whose influence in Catholic theology has been unparalleled. He's the one theologian that every person becoming a Catholic priest really has to study. At the end of his life, had a kind of religious experience. And after having written thousands and thousands of pages of theology, in the middle of his great work, the Summa Theologiae, put his pen down and said, "I cannot write anymore. I've seen this is all straw."
Silence. It is quite a remarkable anecdote about somebody who wrote probably one of the largest output in terms of just the sheer volume, right, of his writing.
Yeah, so I think it says something to us about the riskiness of theology, whether you're a believer or an unbeliever. And if I can draw a maybe you don't want me to draw this parallel, but you can edit it out. If I can draw a parallel with the process of setting up to record a video like this, invisibly, there's a great deal of work that has to go on, which John and I have witnessed this morning. And everything hangs on a pinhead, because it could be that one of the cameras cuts out, yes, or the audio fails, and it was worth nothing.
Who knows?
Yes. And if you sort of multiply that by your life, well, that's what hangs in the balance.
That's true. I just want to remind the listeners that there's a donations link available in the description to be able to support us for all the work that goes into these podcasts. You're touching on something that I wanted to bring up, actually, which is the idea of personal involvement with theology. You can do it as a completely detached discipline, or you can make it something that connects with you. I was thinking of Socrates, right? The idea that when you study Plato's Socratic dialogues, there's one element that some scholars would emphasize, which is that Socrates would only engage somebody trying to find out those convictions that he was convicted of. So those ideas that he was personally involved in, and he wouldn't discuss something with them without that involvement. So I think I want to make the point about Dawkins's theory of what theology is at best, anthropology, that I think he gets it wrong even with anthropology itself, because he has a vision of anthropology as the detached observation of somebody who presumably comes from a wealthy country that has universities that can train people in anthropology, and then goes to another culture, and then they just take detached notes and observations about that culture. But actually, anthropology is a participative discipline in and of itself. So the idea of anthropologists, I would understand in a more contemporary sense, is participant observation. You go into the culture, you immerse yourself in the culture, and you actually live like them. So it can't just be this detached position that objectifies that which you study, right? And I understand, John, in your case, you were saying that something that you were looking for is a kind of theology that would connect more with your own total experience of what the faith is, and not just simply that more sociological approach to religious studies or theology, which is just a description of what it is. Can you tell us about your experience when you went to you went on to study theology, where you did it, what courses you had, how it clicked with you, what was it exactly that you were looking for?
A quick point first on what you two were saying. Your question relates exactly to, I think, a bit the difference between anthropology and, as Dawkins understands it, and theology, which is the goal often emphasized at the ITI, the International Theological Institute in Austria, where I studied, which I'll say more about in a moment. And my own personal approach and what led me there is the idea that we accept that the faith and the doctrines as promulgated by the Catholic Church are true. We accept this, we accept there is a God, and now we try to understand more about it, and you know, okay, we say we believe that God is Trinity, you know, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Okay, we believe this. Now, is it possible to say something about it, right?
So you're saying that theology in a way presupposes faith. Yes. Sorry for interrupting you.
So you believe, and now what can you say about what can we say something about it? Being very conscious, and I think this is what I wanted to say. So Brother Bede was saying that, with reference to Thomas Aquinas and the anecdote that all his work is straw, that what we can possibly say or understand in this life with our human limitations pales in comparison to the reality in heaven. But we want to, because we believe it, and because we love God, and because we want to come closer to Him and understand and fully give Him thanks, and in some way know what we're giving Him thanks for, and how we want to be able to understand it, because if you love someone, you want to know more about them, and you want to understand and be able to say more about it, as opposed to what I would say study history or philosophy, which would be to gain new knowledge about something with a sort of certain detachment. So the approach is very different. Mm-hmm. That's what led me to the ITI. Mm-hmm. And if you could ask your question again, because yeah. I've been speaking for rather a long time.
No, that's fine, because I was thinking of all the podcast episodes we've done so far,
yeah.
where the topic of love as the foundation of the intellectual inquiry has come up, right? Yeah. So it's not just a neutral intellectual inquiry, which we just start randomly because we're curious. It can be that case, and I think the case of Alex O'Connor is a bit that, because he wanted to know more about the workings of theology as an academic discipline. But you touch on something, which is the idea that it presupposes a certain involvement, a certain yeah. faith, a certain love. So I wanted to, if you can give us a little bit of a glimpse of what theology looks like at the ITI as a more thoroughly Catholic kind of theology when it's in this tradition. For example, what courses did you have? Like, what does a theology student do?
So the ITI was founded by Pope John Paul II, Saint John Paul II, as a place where lay people can also study theology. And as I understand it, it's one of a very small number of places in Europe where one can do so and receive pontifical degrees. So degrees recognized by the Vatican. So what I studied, it was called a Sacred Theology Masters, but it corresponds to...
Very, very cool name.
Yeah, very cool name. It corresponds to the SDB, which would be the first step in the ecclesiastical system. So, in theory, it should be 5 years, 3 years of philosophy, 2 years of theology, because I already had a degree and including some philosophical courses. Therefore, the first 3 years was shortened to one, where I studied some scripture, theology, and a few other courses, Latin also, and then 2 years of 2 years of theology.
Right, so scripture would be one part of what you do in theology. You were mentioning this before, right? You have some kind of description or study of the monuments of Christian history, so to say. So the Bible being one of them, you would say. And then you have the Christian tradition or the writers that have come afterwards, and you study them as well. And then you have a more systematic kind of theology, which is more logical or philosophical in nature.
Yes, so the ITI is definitely strongly a Thomist institute.
Okay, well, what does Thomist mean? Yeah.
Yeah, Thomist meaning... yes, this,
we're basically pointing at Brother Bede. For
Brother Bede, so, yes. Meaning that we study theology very much through the system of the Summa Theologica, as Thomas Aquinas.
I'm not sure if Bede is a Thomist or not. Maybe we pointed at him too quickly, because you can be a Dominican and not be a Thomist, but Thomism is quite a big trend in yes. Catholic theology, yes.
Yes.
So you do these courses?
Yes. So how the final 2 years of the program, the theology component of the degree look, is there's always, first you study scripture as a whole to gain an overview. Then you always have some courses of scripture. There's Greek, of course, New Testament Greek. And then basically the course is built more or less along the lines of the Summa Theologica. So there's some... for some courses, like say ecclesiology or the Trinity, we'd study what the Church Fathers have to say, but then it would be very much built on quite following the structure of the Summa Theologica. So if one were to have, say, the list of the questions of the Summa Theologica on the one hand and the list of courses of the ITI on the other hand, one would get quite an idea of the structure. First of we'd have subjects such as, you know, the one God, what we can say about God, faith and reason. Then after that, right, we have, okay, God as our end in Aristotelian Thomistic terms, right, our goal, our purpose. And then how do we as human beings reach that? So then you have moral theology, how we reach that, our goal, God, our will, our passion, virtues, vices, sin, And then after more the natural theological foundation, then come the Trinity, ecclesiology, law, grace, and so on. Mm-hmm. And if that makes sense,
yes.
Don't see.
I'm thinking that that's exactly the kind of theology that Richard Dawkins is saying, well, that's just logic chopping, as he calls it, right?
Exactly.
It's pointless. But I think, would you agree that there's a paradox that emerges here in that, on the one hand, we want to assert that an academic discipline named theology is possible, which is on the basis of these monuments, of these tradition and the scriptures, we can build a whole academic system of rational thinking about these topics, like the Trinity or what the nature of the church is. But at the same time, there's an inadequacy to it. Like Brother Bede was saying before, it seems that all of this is very fragile, because after all, you know, what matters is knowledge of God, so to say. And even St. Thomas Aquinas, at the end of his day, said, well, all of this is just straw compared to my life of faith, my experience of God, beyond the academic exercise of theology. So on the one hand, you seem to have the necessity for a rational form of discourse that makes theology possible in an academic setting. But on the other hand, at the same time, the believer will say, well, but theology is just not adequate in itself. How would you agree that there's this paradox in Christian theology?
Well, sometimes people get surprised when they pick up a Bible and they think it's going to be like or sometimes even the way that Richard Dawkins or someone like that speaks about the Bible, and you think that the Bible is going to be like a textbook which tells you about God and the world and how he made it. Apparently he did it in 6 days. And actually people, if they take the time really to read the Bible and see what it says, should be quite disappointed, because the Bible is much more messy and isn't very helpful at all as a textbook. If you read the letters of St. Paul, sometimes he doesn't even write in full sentences. So the reason that Christians down the ages have felt the need to systematize, I mean, it's worth saying that this Summa Theologiae, this book we've been talking about by Thomas Aquinas, all it means is a summary of theology. And it was a textbook he made, because actually the sources of Christian faith, the monuments that you mentioned earlier, are extremely messy. And so scripture is meant to be a witness to the foundational self-understanding, the foundational events which make Christianity, particularly in the New Testament, but with a kind of prehistory in the Old Testament. But more than that, it's also meant to be a prayer book. It's meant to be something that gives us a kind of, doesn't tell us what God is. It gives us a kind of character sketch of God by showing how he deals with human beings throughout history, or at least in a certain kind of understanding of history that such as it could be had by the people who wrote it, because history in the modern sense of the word is a quite modern discipline. But the advantage of that messiness, the advantage of the fact that Christian life is really conducted in prayer rather than in study, is the fact that there's always a surfeit, there's always an excess. So the point of the Bible is not to give you an exhaustive, complete description of what God is like, or what human beings are like, or what the meaning of the universe is. It's actually meant to bring about a conversion of heart. It's something that you engage with, not simply to put something in your head, but to change your heart. And even our study of theology in a certain way should really be directed towards that. If we bear in mind that it's only going to be a very limited take on the way that things really are, the way that God really is, we shouldn't expect to have an exhaustive description of God, the universe, and everything. It's not aiming at a unified theory of everything like some people think physics is. It isn't aiming either at complete proofs like mathematics does. And it isn't aiming at establishing a consensus like some of the social sciences are. It's an exercise that only really makes sense within the whole life of the church, or the whole life of a given believer. And that's why there's always a kind of remainder which you can't get at, because, and this is why, where you can see, I suppose, the Christian roots of existentialism, that there's the ultimate question to be answered is not a question that you can write down on a piece of paper. It's the question which is my life, my being, my existence. And you only answer that by living.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There's two things I'd like to add to that, if I may.
You may.
Thank you. This is my English side. Too polite.
Too polite.
Yeah. I should just channel my Hungarian directness here. The first thing is a bit on maybe the early stages of Christian theology, which is we can often tend to look at, you know, when we think theology, we can look at these, you know, or these thousands of volumes regularly produced, or at St. Thomas Aquinas. But if we look at how it started, I often got an impression reading the Church Fathers that there's this, the very early stages, there's this reluctance to try and pin things down and speak in precise terms. And it would in fact be the various early heretics who would make these really bold claims, often bringing in with a Greek philosophical background. So sometimes they'd be of the Alexandrian school, say in the early centuries, with a strong philosophical tradition. They'd make these bold claims, and the first reaction of the Church Fathers who had tried to tackle these would be outrage. It seems like almost like, how dare you try to not so much as to how dare you speak error, that too, but how dare you try to sort of say such things about this great mystery which we should just sort of bow in awe before, you know? And then they had to sort of formulate something in response. So if we're not, if you say, for instance, that, you know, or the, a lot of the early heresies were about the nature of Christ, right? You know, he's purely human, or he's purely divine, or the divine aspect of Christ left him on the cross, leaving the human Jesus to die, or he only appeared to die, or so on. If you're confronted with this, then you have to formulate in response what actually happened. So the impression I got was that especially those only a few generations away from Christ, say someone like, you know, Saint Irenaeus, who was a disciple of John, who was a disciple of Christ, so very close link. To me, it gives a quite different impression than, say, Church Fathers a century or two later, right? So it's the sense that maybe one could make a case for the fact that the Church was dragged into theology, at least initially. Sadly, I can't remember enough specifics to support this. I wish I could make a few quotes. That's the first point. The second point relates to the messiness of the Bible that you were talking about, and I was struck by a quote from Pascal. And he says that there's enough light in the scriptures for those who seek it, and enough obscurity for those of a contrary disposition. I paraphrase him. In other words, there has to be the aspect of faith. You know, Christ could have revealed himself so clearly, as to put all doubt to rest. You know. He could have revealed himself in Rome, the heart of the empire, right? But as it was, he chose the provincial backwater. Often his miracles, he would tell people not to tell them. He accepted death seemingly at the very height of his power, right? So all this, and then he left us with these scriptures, which we've spent two millennia trying to piece together and form a theological system from. And partly there's a role for what we said before, which was, we believe, and now we try to understand and say something about what we have faith in and what we love. But partly there has to be this aspect of faith, right? So it's not meant to be like a philosophical system with the weight of divine authority, which is so clear and so structured, you know, that you couldn't avoid its truth. There has to be an aspect, there has to be room for believing for something that's not completely clear, which seems to not make sense. And there's a lot in the Bible which doesn't seem to make sense, right? But nevertheless, to have faith and understand. And there's so many times when, for me in my studies, where you look deep into a particular passage of scripture, say, and then with the assumption that there's truth here and we just have to find it. And if you look really deeply into it, you'd say find all the significance, which you wouldn't have thought of looking for before. But you have to have the right mindset and the right faith in order to uncover it. Hence the quote from Pascal.
Mm-hmm. We touched on that in a previous episode, talking about faith and the nature of faith and how there was something conclusive about Christian faith, where you can do all the searching, intellectually speaking, that you want. And that's good, actually, and necessary for many people. But then there comes a point where you have to involve yourself through this personal decision, which is connecting to what you said before about personal involvement. There's many interesting points that have come up. And I'm going to do a little bit of a recap to orient a little bit what we're saying. But the excess of the Christian tradition that you were talking about, in a way, is due to the fact that it's an event, it's something that happened, we would claim, and we are incorporated into that history.
Yeah, well, it's still happening.
And it's still happening, exactly. One thing I usually tell some friends is to look at the genres of the New Testament. Like, the New Testament has narrative and letter writing. It has the apocalypse as well, which is slightly the one out. But you have an essentially narrative mode of being for Christianity, which is events that are kept in memory and brought to bear in our own lives through that memory and participation in those.
Yeah, I mean, we keep coming back to the Bible, and I mean, not just in the sense we keep on talking about it here, but Christians have the Bible as an authoritative thing that they, you know, we read it every Sunday at Mass, we read it every day, in fact, in various official forms of prayer that the Church has. And as it stands, the way that Catholics read the Bible in Mass means that if a Catholic went to Mass every day, he would hear the whole of the Bible every 3 years. And
little advertising here.
So
go and to the Catholic family.
Well,
we do have a good cycle of readings.
Yes, if you want to get to know the Bible. But that means that, you know, there's an awful lot of repetition. And although the Bible can look like a big book, there's only so much in it, and there are certain bits that obviously stand out. But the reason we can go back to it again and again is because this touches on my life. And, St. Paul is writing to various communities of Christians, but his letters are written as if to us as well. And he says in his letters that we should read the Old Testament as if it's addressed to us as well. He says that these things weren't written just for the sake of the people who lived at the time. In fact, it wasn't the people at the time who wrote it most often. It was written centuries after. It's written for those of us who come at the end of the age, he says, who can use these narratives to give some kind of narrative structure and sense to our own lives as Christians and our own interactions with God. And I think it's a striking thing that any Christian who's taken the time to read scripture deeply notices that you come back to the Bible again and again and again, and it can show new meanings that you never expected. You read a sentence or a phrase and it strikes you in a different way. And partly that's the subtlety of any work of literature, or any rich or poetic formulation of language. But it's also partly a function of the fact that we are always changing and growing. You mentioned, no, you didn't mention, sorry, but...
I can edit it.
There's a famous English Catholic called, who was made a saint recently, called John Henry Newman. And Newman, in one of his great works, just before he became a Catholic, he'd been an Anglican before, said that to live is to change, and to be perfect is to have changed often. And Christians experience, I think, this. We certainly don't become perfect, most of us, but experience this sense of changing and growing. And of course, this is a function of any human life. But we believe that because God has taken on the form of a human life, because he became man in Jesus, actually just by living a human life and by an openness to God in our lives, that life can become the place where we meet God, mm-hmm. even now, even today, and not just 2,000 years ago when Jesus was on the earth.
But I want to throw in a bit of a challenge to this. So we were talking about how you have a community in place, which is the Christian community, that continues an event that isn't going until today. And picking up on the point you made about theology almost being accidental. So you have times in the church, in the history of the church, you have people who've arisen who have their own system and they want to challenge some of the, or at least to take some of the basic assumptions of Christianity in a new, different direction. And out of a rational necessity, you need to provide a rational discourse that challenges some of these disagreements, because it's an ongoing event. You have to interpret it because it's literary in nature. But then, so there arises theology as a systematic rational discourse and discipline. I mean, the way I put it in the past is that the church, because it's universal, it encompasses all different psychological temperaments. So you have people who are more creative, people who are more intellectually oriented, people who are more effective, for example. And I would say it's the intellectual characters maybe that need to have some rational answers that are suited to their own capacities and their own personality. So there you have systems arising, right? So how can we reconcile the reality, the messy and changing nature of the Christian history and the Christian reflection on the Bible, with there being systems of theology, both orthodox and heretical, that seem to contradict that static nature?
Yeah, I think actually the word system is not very helpful in many ways, because it suggests something that's complete and self-enclosed. We've mentioned several times, not just the Bible, but Thomas Aquinas and his big book, The Summary of Theology, the Summa Theologiae. If you read the Summa Theologiae, historically some people have tried to read it and get a nice rounded picture out of it. Now, that's not possible because Thomas didn't finish it, for one thing. But it's also not possible because the way that he often operates is by saying what we can't say. So he says very near the beginning of the work, theology is meant to be about what God is, but we can't say what God is. So theology is about what God is not. And that negative way of phrasing things carries on throughout the work. And if you look at what he says about things like the Trinity or Christology, these classic logic chopping parts of Christianity, as Richard Dawkins would call them, actually what you find is he's trying to sketch out what's out of bounds. And the end result is something like a Picasso picture, I think, because you have these funny shapes, some of which work as discrete units, but they don't quite fit together in a perfect whole. The thing isn't perfectly understandable. And so there's always at the end a remainder where we can only say, well, this is what we believe. So the classic example is transubstantiation. Catholics believe that in the Mass, the bread and wine that is offered up and prayed over become the body and blood of Christ, and yet they retain all the appearance and properties of bread and wine. And Thomas describes this process as transubstantiation. He says that in Aristotelian terms, so using a language provided by the reigning philosophy of his day, that the substance of the bread and wine become the body and blood of Christ, even though the accidents, the appearances, remain intact. But actually, that isn't explaining at all what has gone on. That isn't giving you a mechanism. It's not like a scientific hypothesis which you can put to the test. Or again, Christology. Thomas says that the word of God in Jesus Christ became hypostatically united to a man. And he tries to say very carefully what hypostatic union means, but in the end, this is simply a formulation that has come down. It's the one formulation we have that doesn't break the rules of the way that we need to speak if we're going to carry on being Christians and true to the events that have happened. Now, this, if it were an intellectual system, if this were a philosophy, would seem to be a very great weakness, because you seem to have bits of your system which actually have no foundation. They have nothing to rest on. But because it's not a system, and because it's not self-standing, because it isn't just an intellectual construction, because it's rooted in Christian life, we can actually say, no, this does work because it describes what we hold be true. It describes how we worship God. It describes the mystery that we have received. And mystery, which is a term that can sound a bit vague or make us think of a detective story, here actually to a Christian speaks to the absolute essence of our religion, because we believe that God himself is a mystery. God is incomprehensible. And even actually when we get to heaven and we see everything in a clearer light, God is going to remain mysterious in some way.
You both touched on something, one theme that has surfaced in what you both said, which is, I would put it by saying that the Christian tradition has an integral vision of what it means to be human, right? Both at the individual and the social level. So you might be a very intellectually oriented person, but you might be somebody who is not intellectually oriented. Well, there's room for you in the Catholic Church, right? That all temperaments, all personalities should find their own space. So there's something satisfying, I think, satisfactory about satisfying the mind and satisfying the heart in what Christianity has to offer. But also at the social level, you have a community where some people have to occupy the position of ruling and controlling, which exists, or authority rather, we would say, which exists in all societies. But also people have to occupy the position of the thinkers, those that ask questions and push them further, right? They explore. So maybe we can come here and we close the conversation with this idea. But to the one of the inadequacies of theology, which is that it does satisfy this very specific aspect, but it's limited in that it only satisfies the intellectual aspect of Christian life. Some people complain that they've had a very intellectual formation, but the heart is starving. They don't really feel any emotional connection with Christianity because it was all very formulaic or academic, right? Connection with this, I can think of many ways of phrasing this, but on the one hand, I think of John Vervaeke, who is a cognitive scientist at the University of Toronto, who's embarked on this very interesting project of what he calls cognitive science of wisdom, making the point that the sciences, academic study of the human being, has become focused on knowledge, but he distinguishes that from wisdom. And he says there's something else that we're missing at the moment, which is that extra bit of meaningfulness or how to live our lives, which just sheer academic knowledge does not give us, and he calls that wisdom. There's also the idea of beauty, right, which I was going to ask you as a writer, someone who's actually now pursuing a more artistic career. It's another way of approaching God or knowing God. Would you like to say a little bit about how those ways work?
You read my mind, because that was exactly the point I was going to make before, but not from the perspective of artistic creativity, right? Though, yes, in the last couple of years, I've gone in the direction of writing fiction and maybe exploring concepts of theology or philosophy, and to a lesser extent, theology through that. But I was going to make it from a different perspective, which is the question you asked 5 or 10 minutes before, are there different ways of doing theology? And now you said that some people say that theology is too intellectual. So in response to those two, there's the possibility of a theology of beauty. One theologian who attempted this, who I have yet to read, but I find the concept very interesting, is von Balthasar.
Mm-hmm. Who came up in a previous episode.
Okay.
When was this? The one on faith, actually, because he was mentioned as precisely the one that talks about the aesthetics or theological aesthetics, right? The epidermis, is that a word? No. The outer layer of your skin, somebody said, of the faith. That's how things impact you. But sorry for the interruption.
Yes. So I actually wrote my master's thesis on a philosophy of beauty, and it's a very strong theme in Platonist philosophy. And to a lesser extent, it's also present in Aristotle, who doesn't have a systematic view of it. But I tried to piece together a philosophy of beauty, and then at the end, because ostensibly it was supposed to be a theology master's, I asked the question at the end whether we could have a theology of beauty. And we could see beauty as something, and this is how the Platonists tend to see it, in some ways the radiation of the divine, right? how the divine reveals itself, right, through beauty, and whether we see that as now when we say beauty, we tend to think of natural beauty, but the beauty of the human body, and of the beauty of the soul, the mind, absolute beauty, and it radiates. Right, it's intensely attractive, and it draws us towards it. So it's this sort of this complete process, and we could see God's revelation in this way. Imagine a possibility where you see as God's revelation in terms of beauty, and where potentially we could see our conscience in terms of what we're drawn to is what's beautiful, and what we're repelled by, what our conscience tells us is wrong, is what is ugly and repellent, not merely wrong in a way that could be comprehended and described by the intellect. And then we could see that as beauty. We could definitely talk of, say, I've been attracted to the idea of an ethics of beauty, say, or maybe one of the important subjects, one of the focus of the ITI, it was partially offering degrees of theology such as I took, and partially an institute on marriage and the family. So the theology of marriage had a big focus there, and I thought I mentioned this because another aspect of the theology of beauty, potentially, just to give examples how it could potentially be done, would be to understand, right, the idea of the marriage and the husband and wife coming together and love creating new life. To me, this is also intensely, and at the human level at least, supremely beautiful. And one could speculate, and I only got as far really as asking these questions. Mm-hmm. But that could potentially be another way.
Those questions are actually really quite interesting, and connecting this back to what Ulysses was saying earlier about wisdom. In the Old Testament, we find the Hebrews became increasingly, the religious writers of the Hebrews became increasingly interested in the figure of wisdom. And wisdom, they always personified as a woman. And part of the significance of this, I think, is to show that wisdom is beautiful, even archetypally beautiful. And this is a topic of considerable contention among scholars, and it's something that's hard to figure out whether you're a believer or not a believer, what exactly the relationship of wisdom in the Old Testament is to God, because wisdom apparently helped God in creating the universe. But at other times, the Old Testament says that wisdom was the first part of God's creation. And wisdom is also associated with God's law, with the way that we live our lives. And there seems to be something that I suppose you can glean from this, is that there's a way in which wisdom acts as a kind of interface between God and humanity. Now, I think this is interesting because in the what we might think of as the earlier parts of the Old Testament, often God is more terrifying. If you think of the giving of the law in the book of Exodus, God appears to Moses and the people of Israel in a great thunderstorm, in clouds, surrounded by earthquakes, in a fire. He seems to summon up all the vital and terrifying energy of the natural world. And the people cannot see God, because to see God is to die. And later, when the Ark of the Covenant is brought to Israel, if people touch the Ark without being appropriately sanctified, they die. Wisdom seems to be the way in which God becomes accessible to human beings, in which God clothes himself in such a way that we can look on him and appreciate him and allow him to enter our lives and change our lives. And he does that by becoming beautiful to us. So for Jews, and this is the case even today, we look at the Jewish law and we instinctively from the outside think, gosh, what a burden. For the Jew, the law is the most beautiful thing conceivable, because it's the way that we walk with God. And here we get to a picture of God that we find actually most often at the beginning of the Old Testament, in the first few chapters of the book of Genesis, where God walks among his people. God walks with us. And he comes to Adam and Eve in the garden, for instance. He walks alongside Noah. He walks alongside Enoch and enters into a kind of friendship with these people. Later, wisdom would be identified with the Son of God, with the Word who became flesh, with Jesus Christ, who for Christians is, of course, God walking among us, God making himself attractive to us. People, there's a long tradition in Catholicism of reading the Gospels and trying to imagine yourself in the situation that's described, in the scene that's described, to insert yourself into the narrative. And very often what people find when they do this is that there's something transfixing about Jesus. If you can get over the ugliness and the institutionalization that we so often associate with Christianity or with the Catholic Church today, read the Gospel of Mark and simply see Jesus as he was. There's something very compelling about him as a figure. Or you think of the way that the disciples interact with him, how a single glance from Jesus seems to be sufficient to move people to tears, to move people to a recognition of their own ugliness and unworthiness. Jesus isn't a platonic form. He's not anything out of the ordinary. He just is human being as human being is meant to be. And more than that, he is God showing himself to us. And in the face of that, we learn something about ourselves. Beauty is often conceived of in ancient philosophy as a kind of light. So John spoke of beauty as a kind of emanation or an overflowing or a pouring out. And there's a way in which Jesus does just that for us. He's a light that shines and a light that draws us, turns our faces to it, and helps us to see things more clearly. So this ties back actually to something that we said very near the beginning, that theology is a risky business, makes you vulnerable. Because it doesn't just put God into question, but it puts ultimately ourselves into question. And says, what is the kind of life I have been living? What is the kind of life I intend to live?
One quick addition to that, that the word often used for good in the New Testament, kalos, can actually equally be interpreted as beautiful. Mm-hmm. So if we were to go and look at all those instances and say, instead of when Jesus says, I am the good shepherd, I am the beautiful shepherd, for example, which is exactly
as we know shepherds are, well,
no, which is what we think, but that would, if we could somehow overcome the initial reaction, that might sort of help us see him in a bit as how Brother Reed was just describing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because there's an interesting, I mean, to simplify maybe a little bit, there's this narrative theme in the Old Testament about wisdom. And it seems to be transmuted when we go to the New Testament from the Chokmah, which is the word for wisdom in Hebrew, right, to the Logos in Greek. When you get the beginning of the Gospel of John, where it says the Logos, which was from the beginning, has now become the Word incarnate, who is Jesus Christ himself. And then it seems that there's something rationalistic about it. And when you were saying how the wisdom becomes the Son of God, I was expecting you to say who is truth or reason or whatever. You said beauty particularly, right? And it's something that is counterintuitive perhaps, because maybe there has been a bit of a rationalistic understanding of that logos, but actually it's not just simply reason in the Greek sense, but it's something that shines forth as beauty as well, right? So in the sense that you were saying, the integral vision that Christianity has at the heart is not just ideal humanity, but the actual humanity of a person who is Jesus Christ, who is radiant, not just because he's truthful, but also because he invites us to enter into a relationship with him. And that relationship puts us at danger, at risk, in a way, because it's like any other relationship. You can have a conversation and reason with that person, but actually there's something more that draws you into it. I don't know if we want to say some final...
Well, I think it's... I mean, just on that point, it's amazing looking at the mystic tradition from the ancient Hebrew prophets right through to... in Spain, especially famous Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross, and through to our own day, how often erotic imagery comes up, or marriage imagery, to note what John was saying earlier about the particular role of reflection on the family can have in theology in our day. How often erotic imagery comes up to describe our relationship with God, which is, well, certainly not the first thing that most of us think about. But it says something about the sense of being overpowered that a life of religious faith can leave you with, that we find ourselves embarked on a journey that we never really expected to have. And I suppose, because like you say, any relationship is unpredictable, there are turns it takes that no one could have foreseen, and sometimes those turns seem to come about from things going drastically wrong, and sometimes they come about when things go so drastically right. And one theologian in the 20th century said, our theology should be a love letter. Maybe it's not written in the terms that we'd usually associate with a love letter, but I think there's a truth in that. Our theology, I think what we've been saying all along throughout this podcast is there should be something personal about our theology, and something that touches on our lives. Not, it can't just be a compartment we have, or even just a compartment of the church's life, but something that has a kind of circular relationship to everything else. It's fed by real experience, and it gives us a way of making sense of our real experience that allows us to appropriate it more richly.
Yeah, we've touched on something so interesting, theology and beauty. We could talk about it for a long time. You have to come back. We have to do a second part on this for the next podcast, next occasion. I'd like to leave you with the last word, the artist in the room. Would you like to say something else?
Give me something to go on.
Okay. If somebody says to you, I can make sense of the idea of God, but I don't know where to start looking for him. I'd like to enter into this relationship that goes beyond the merely intellectual, right? I can have an intellectual idea of God and form some kind of even academic sense of what he is or what he should be. But my heart is not satisfied with it. Where would you tell them to start looking for?
Wow, there's a lot of different things. Maybe I can share something from personal experience. In my second year of this 3-year course, I actually had a bit of a moment like that myself, and where I didn't want to read or contemplate or discuss theology for a while. I wanted a break, and one thing I did at that time, I was the ITI is near to Vienna, and I went in there and I went to the National Library because I'd heard it's one of the attractions of the city, and I didn't know what to expect. And I'd never seen a picture of it, and I opened the door, and instantly I was floored by its beauty, right? These wonderful rows of bookshelves and the old books and the art and the floor and the pillars, everything just instantly. And I just stood there for minutes just coming to terms with it. And that's one of the things which led me into the direction of thinking about beauty. And that was one experience of, obviously at the first level, just the experience itself. And then you can lead on to ideas of thing it had for me is like the whole is greater than the parts. So you can look at all the books and the art and so on, and you put them together, and you still don't get the whole. There was something. These basic terms, definitely immaterial about it. Something sublime. Something that sort of lifted me up and my mind and my spirit, and. For me, well, that set me on a path to sort of try and view things a bit less intellectually, or rather alongside that aesthetically. and that could be one thing. I mean, there are many things. Like go on walk in nature, talk to someone, and try and see the beautiful in them, and tie that back into theology if that's what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll stop there at the crossroads. Thank you for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you here with us.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.